Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
All right, welcome everyone to the February 2025 edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Special thank you again to our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, for making it possible for us to be here together today. And I already see we have a really large audience for today, which is exciting because we will be discussing some evidence-based guidelines. As always, I'm Remley, and I am joined today by Dr. Tony Fernandez, Michael Caduce, and Dr. Bill Toon. And I would like to give a special warm welcome to our guest of honor, Dr. Christian Martingale.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And for those at home listening, the paper that we will be reviewing in Journal Club today is a 2024 systematic review of evidence-based guidelines for pre-hospital care. And this is published open access in pre-hospital emergency care. Encourage you all to check it out. And as always, our article will be paired with a discussion in EMS World written by our very own columnist, Michael Caduce. The name of that section is called Journal Watch. Encourage you all to check out the article at emsworld.com under Education and Training. And for those of you who are listening live, thank you for joining us today. Reminder that you can use your chat feature and type in questions and comments, and we'll bring those into the discussion as we go. Now, we've got lots of exciting stuff, so without further ado, let's kick off with an introduction. So, Dr. Martingale, who are you and how did you get involved in EMS research?
I appreciate it. And again, thanks for having me. I'm an emergency and EMS physician, also a nationally registered paramedic and flight paramedic. I love my roots in paramedicine, and most of what I do these days is related to EMS work. I'm at the University of Pittsburgh, where I have the pleasure of being the chief of our division of EMS, where we have a couple dozen physicians that are involved in the medical oversight of EMS agencies, a larger medical service. And I have the pleasure of collaborating in a variety of EMS-related research and other activities.
Many hats, like many of us in EMS. Love it. So we're going to be talking about your article, and I'm curious, before we dive into the specifics, and of course we'll hit methods and results and all of that, but maybe you could give us a little bit of background on what made you all decide to take this on, or how did this project come about?
Yeah, so I'll try to give the just a few minutes summary of what's really unfolded over just over a decade. Turn it out that back in 2013, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration wanted an entity to help develop a strategy that would help national organizations work together to promote the development, implementation, and evaluation of evidence-based guidelines for pre-hospital care. And so the National Association of EMS Physicians partnered with NHTSA to develop that strategy, and I got to be able to help organize the team that put that together. The first step of that strategy was to create a consortium of what is now a few dozen national organizations that work together to try to promote evidence-based guidelines for EMS. And that organization called the Pre-Hospital Guidelines Consortium has now been alive and well for almost a decade. And we now help to do things like develop a registry and have online a registry of EMS guidelines. And this 2024 review is actually the third now biennial, every other year, systematic review of evidence-based guidelines, where we aim to find all of the evidence-based guidelines that are being published out there and actually evaluate the quality of them. So we can identify, based on some standardized criteria, which of those guidelines are high-quality ones that we should really try to promote in terms of education, incorporation into training or into testing for EMS personnel, and also help to promote the improvement in quality of guidelines moving forward.
And what an incredible resource it is to have this in one place. Often these guidelines come out and they might be behind paywalls or in peer-reviewed literature, and sometimes getting that to where these guidelines can actually be enacted at the front line can be a big challenge. So I am a huge fan of this work and pulling it all together, and I know that doing so is no easy feat. And we're going to dive into the methods, so I'll bring Dr. Tony Fernandez on to talk a little bit about it's not as you hear systematic review, and sometimes I think that's misleadingly thought of as, oh, this will be a simple project where, I just find all the articles on a topic. But it's actually quite challenging. And then with the additional layers that you all put on it of evaluating the quality of the evidence and the reporting, we will stay tuned. We'll see how that all went. Tony, I'll flip it over to you. I don't want to spoil anything.
All right. Well, thank you. And again, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this article. I think this is going to be really important. And again, just to echo Remley's point, how valuable it is to have this all in one spot. So we talked a little bit about the systematic review and how you did some appraisals there. But the second line in your method section, I think, is so important that you used a research librarian to help you search these databases. And can you just speak to that? What a resource, important resource that is to have. Can you help our audience understand kind of how you got in touch with a research librarian and how they were able to help you in this study?
Yeah, so I definitely want to take the first opportunity that I have to thank the whole research team and the whole team that put the systematic review together. Starting with that, the identification of the literature. Rose Turner was a research librarian at the University of Pittsburgh that has helped us with our last two systematic reviews, and was a resource that we happen to have here at the University of Pittsburgh, like many other folks have at their academic institutions. And these are folks that are experts in searching databases of articles so that you can try to have fairly good certainty that you are really trying to find the denominator of what publications may be relevant to the search that you're doing. The other co-authors, I just want to take an opportunity to thank as well. We had Daniel Patterson, Chris Richards, Rebecca Cash were my co-investigators who appraised each of the articles. We'll get to that process, I'm sure, here in a little bit. They did a tremendous amount of work to individually review each of the guidelines that were reviewed. And Anji Misra and Ben Potts, who helped with the screening of the guidelines, which is the next step that comes after the research librarian's work.
And I'll butt in there and say, what a great mix of both physician and EMS clinician authors, because a lot of times I think, oh, well, I'm an EMT, and maybe, but a lot of the authorship on this is professionals as well as the physician members working together. So what a great team.
Exactly. Right from we've got two line paramedics right in that author list. PhD individuals, physicians. I think that is very valuable to get individual perspectives in the EMS world.
Oh, absolutely. And so let's dive back into the study here. So you looked for articles that were published between January 1, 2021 and June 6, 2023. And you incorporated some the time from a 20 there was a 2022 systematic review, and you overlapped some of that time. I thought that was a really wise decision because of some publication snafus or when things were actually available online. Can you talk to us about that decision and how you chose your time frame for this study?
Yeah, that's important. It also brings up the point that any time that we do a search of the literature, is any time that somebody's doing a systematic review of what literature is out there, you really have to be mindful of what criteria you use to try to identify the publications you're trying to find. And so one of the things that we did to make sure that we didn't miss publications between reviews is to have that overlap of time periods. Sometimes there are publications that are put early online, sometimes they're finally published in final form online, or then they go into print. And so journals can be squirrely about what the official publication date ends up being, depending on where you're accessing that information. And so we wanted to try to not lose some of the publications in between those. And then another thing that's related to that, that we aim to change every time we do this now, every other year systematic review, is adapting the search terms that we use for looking up those publications to make sure that we're as inclusive as possible while not having too much noise of publications that clearly are not going to be relevant. And we made some edits to those search terms that we used this time around, as we usually do.
Yeah, and I thought that those edits were really fascinating, because some of the things that you ended up excluding were not intuitive, right? But you were able to find them in other search terms. So things like patient transport, and I believe paramedic was one of the ones that you ended up excluding, because you were able to already capture those with the other search terms in your list. And can you speak to kind of that, how that came to be, and how some of those couldn't have been easy decisions between you and your team? And how did that back and forth go?
Yeah, so this goes back to your excellent comment that it's very valuable to have a research librarian working with you, because they are experts in trying to finagle search terms and figure out the best mix of them. And so what we did is that we trialed different search terms to try to see what we were capturing with additional ones, and being able to remove ones that were just noise, that were going to capture things that are not relevant, whereas we're already capturing what we need to. And recognize, as we have in a supplementary document, that we have a long list of search terms that we're trying to be as inclusive as possible of EMS literature. And I think that we did a reasonable job of that. In the process of trying to be more inclusive this time around compared to the 2022 review, we actually ended up screening twice as many publications, almost twice as many publications this time around, because we were trying to not miss any guidelines that were there. And one of the challenges that happens in trying to identify pre-hospital guidelines is that there can often be a pre-hospital section to a guideline written primarily for another group of individuals. The best example of this, for example, is stroke guidelines. You might imagine the American Heart Association or American Stroke Association might write a guideline for stroke care. And that guideline largely addresses what should happen when the patient is in the hospital, what CT scans should be obtained, when an MRI should be obtained, should they be on long-term aspirin or other therapy. Largely, the guideline addresses things that aren't related to the pre-hospital setting. However, the first section of many of those guidelines often addresses the pre-hospital component. And it's important for us to be able to access that, to implement that in our EMS systems, and to know that those high-level recommendations are out there. And so one of the things we had to adapt was just to simply include search terms like stroke in our review, so that we could at least review some of those guidelines and understand if there was a substantial pre-hospital component to them that would include them in our review.
Yeah, and I love, it's like we practiced this and we didn't. You teed this up for perfectly. You talked about how you added stroke, and you also added, which I think is nice because you kind of rounded out our field, you added emergency medical dispatch search terms and things like first aid resuscitation. I think that those are really wise decisions. And was that something you did in collaboration with the research librarian as well?
Yes, indeed. That, you know, there are mesh terms that keep getting modified over time, and we want to identify any newer ones or ones that we may have missed previously that are relevant. You know, it's interesting to think about emergency dispatch in this context. There are not many what we would refer to as evidence-based guidelines in that realm, but the groups that work in that space are really interested and involved in creating research and providing evidence base for the dispatch component of EMS. And that evidence base is growing over time. And we want to make sure that we capture that type of guidance document that would be that would meet our inclusion criteria. So it's important to keep thinking about all of those aspects of the EMS world where there may be sufficient research to develop evidence-based guidelines, or we want to capture those as they're produced.
And so you go in and you work with your research librarian, you work with your team, and you find probably a zillion articles, right? That you in manuscripts and things that you can potentially put into your work. Obviously, you can't use all those, so you have to whittle it down with your inclusion criteria. And I think you had three inclusion criteria that were really, I think, important. Can you just talk to us about one, what those were, and how you whittled it down to those three for the inclusion criteria?
Yeah, and this really comes up to our understanding of the term evidence-based guideline. What is an evidence-based guideline? What do we mean by that? The Pre-Hospital Guidelines Consortium came up with our definition of that. It's a simple 3-point definition, and I'll come back to that. But to think about what is an evidence-based guideline, it would be something that concretely goes searching for the literature, scientific research, that is the basis for forming a recommendation about pre-hospital care. And the distinction, for example, would be around documents that provide recommendations for care based purely on a consensus process. Those documents have a great use in our environment. It may be that there's a consensus conference or that a technical panel of experts got together and came up with recommendations. And those are particularly valuable when there is no evidence base available or where there's a very short amount of time needed to develop a recommendation of something, or many position statements, which may be based on very limited or no evidence, but where a professional association needs to provide guidance to their membership or their community, because it's something that might be a question of turmoil or where expert guidance is needed. But what we wanted to really find were those recommendation style documents that are based on an evaluation, a structured evaluation of the research that's out there. So our 3-part definition is number one, it's relevant to pre-hospital care, or what we would define as EMS medicine. Number two, the document aims to provide recommendations. That is the key thing. So, for example, as opposed to a review document that just aims to review evidence that's out there, we're talking about a guideline-style document that aims to create recommendations. And three, that it's based on an organized review of the literature. And this can be tricky. You can imagine that a systematic review of the literature would be probably the highest quality way to do that. Others might do a narrative review of the literature, a rapid review. We try to be as broad as possible. And even if folks said that they did a literature review, we kind of counted that, though it'll come up about how that quality of those are graded. But the distinction then is when somebody might just provide citations for recommendations that they're providing. So you might imagine that somebody wants to provide recommendations for care, and they would cite a study here or there to support their statement. That's different than going into the literature with a PICO question where you're trying to find what evidence is out there to develop your recommendation and where a recommendation is based on that literature review. That encompasses our definition of an evidence-based guideline.
Yeah, and so now you have all, yeah, you whittled it down just to the guidelines that you're going to evaluate, and the work's not done. You've done a tremendous amount of work just to get to this part. Now you have to appraise all this research. So you used a few guidelines to help you with this appraisal, the NAM criteria for clinical practice guidelines and the AGREE tool and the AGREE reporting checklist. Can you talk to us about a little bit about what those are and how they were so useful to you?
Yeah, so the criteria that we used are outlined in the paper. Tables 1 and 2 outlined here. We see table 1 on the screen, what each of those criteria are. The National Academy of Medicine had come up with a list of criteria that were adapted by the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research, AHRQ. And these were the criteria that were being used when guidelines from all other aspects of the medical community were being put into an online repository called guidelines.gov, the National Guidelines Clearinghouse. And they aim to identify essentially what we should consider to be a high-quality guideline. These are guidelines that are systematically developed, meaning that somebody asked a question, they went out to the literature looking for the answer to that question, and then they based a recommendation on what they found from science. It's created by some organization, some professional organization or similar entity, instead of just Chris Martingale wants to provide a bunch of recommendations and sit down and write them. It has some more kind of a group of backing behind those recommendations. The key one here, which we found really limits what we would consider many guidelines as high quality, is that it was based on a systematic review of the literature, and that the individual components of that systematic review are outlined in the publication themselves. And then they do things like assess the benefits and harms of the recommendations in the process of developing those recommendations. And if it includes all of those, then we would consider that a high quality guideline.
Excellent, excellent. And again, thank you for all this work, because I think this is going to be really important to our field. And this is not a light lift. This is really important work, and a lot of it went into it. So before we dive into what you found, I'd like to open it up to our other panelists to see if they have any methods related questions or comments. Thank you again for your work. This is great.
Dr. Martingale, I see we've got a few program directors, so I'm hoping that we have some students also listening in on a few of these things. Just wondering, was there a specific topic that was harder or easier to try and fit into these criteria or to evaluate for these criteria? Like, well, we have a ton of stuff on stroke, so that actually worked out well, or we need more research in this area because they don't fit into these criteria. We have trouble evaluating with these criteria.
Yeah, so that really gets into, it's a great question, because it gets into the individual guidelines that we found. So, you know, we ended up screening over 2,000 articles that we found in the screening process, and we ended up with 33 guidelines, which is a lot, I think. And it's a lot because this was roughly 2-year period of time, plus a little overlap with the last guideline. And that means that we're essentially seeing a new guideline being produced more often than once a month in pre-hospital care. So there's a lot of EMS relevant evidence-based guidelines that are being published out there. And it's really hard to keep track of what all of those are. It's hard for folks to know that they're even out there in the literature. And so that's what this work aims to do, is identify them. And so for those program directors that are out there, and as you think about how you might talk to your students about this and make sure that you incorporate the highest quality guidelines out there, the whole purpose of these systematic reviews is to, one, feed an online registry of pre-hospital guidelines. Two, identify which are the highest quality guidelines. And three, help to disseminate information, as we're doing through this Journal Club podcast, to be able to let people know about some of the highest quality guidelines. So out of those 33 guidelines that we identified, it turned out that only 7 met all of those high quality criteria. Now, the other way that we looked at guidelines, which Remley was showing us just before in table 2, was there's another way that the guidelines were appraised, which was through something called the agree to instrument. And I'm not going to go into all of the details of that because I don't think it's too relevant. But this helps us grade the quality of the evidence evaluation and how the guideline is presented in a more numerical way and a more concrete way. That also helps to evaluate things. But it also helps us figure out how we can improve the quality of guidelines overall and the way that things are reported. And one of the elements that we found through that scoring was that we are often lacking in guidelines in the way that we identify how to implement them. And the domain 5 applicability really has to do with how guidelines tell you how to implement them. So it's one thing in a guideline to say we should give aspirin for patients with chest pain. We should obtain 12 leads in people having chest pain. We should X, Y, Z, right? It's another thing to actually tell you how to do it. If you think back to when chest compression recommendations changed from 15 to 2 to 30 to 2, one of the challenges with implementation is that at the time, AEDs did not have a USB drive you could just plug in and reprogram them. Many EMS agencies had to go out and buy all new AEDs before the guideline could be implemented. And so there are many things that we end up recommending that we will have gaps in implementing because of challenges in thinking through what it would take to actually implement. So the first thing I would say in answer to your question is not just what topics were hit or miss, but what is hit or miss within guidelines themselves and with the way that things are reported. And one of the things that we found across the board is that we need to do a better job of describing to the end user and thinking through as those experts developing the recommendations, how should those recommendations be implemented into EMS systems so that it helps the end user to really implement it. And so in those classrooms out there, those program directors, what I would encourage is as you find opportunities to talk to individuals about the guidelines that are out there, it would also be important to think through, okay, so if this is a high quality guideline and these are the 5 or 6 recommendations that it's providing, think through what types of changes you would need to make in your EMS agency to make these happen. Are these things you're doing already? Are these things that you're going to need to change your equipment, your practices, your protocols? Is it something that you'll need to engage your medical director on? Is it something they're already aware of and trying to change? And those are types of conversations that I think are great to have in the classroom.
I think that's great. I appreciate that. And I think that hopefully gives those that are joining the workforce here very shortly some things to read about and think about as they're going out in the field. It's not just welcome to EMS and then a couple years later, something changes. It's always nice to have that foundation for why those changes occur.
Yeah. And in terms of the types of guidelines that we found, yeah, EMS guidelines are super populated by cardiovascular research and cardiovascular recommendations. If you think about some of the huge players in this game, American Heart Association, you have trauma guidelines from American College of Surgeons, Committee on Trauma. You have a variety of other organizations providing individual recommendations. But you have a lot of cardiovascular related and trauma and stroke related recommendations out there. Some of the areas that we found that really are in need of guidelines through other prior work of the Pre-Hospital Guidelines Consortium is, for example, behavioral emergencies. There are not robust EMS guidelines related to helping us understand how to manage, you know, psychiatric and other behavioral emergencies in the field. Yet those are very common and very challenging encounters for us to have. And so by looking for the guidelines that exist and where the gaps are, we can help to promote individuals to create evidence, evaluate the evidence, and create recommendations based on that evidence that can help EMS practitioners everywhere.
I hear what you're saying is we need more research. It's a good thing there's some up and coming researchers in the audience that I see already.
Indeed, indeed. We always need more research.
That we do. If we knew what we were doing, it would just be called search. So I think this is a really great time to take a quick look through some of the figures and tables and talk maybe in a little bit more detail across some of these that were found. So in figure one, that's a typical figure one, shows us what ended up included, what ended up excluded. And as Tony alluded earlier, even with whittling down search terms, you still get 8 bajillion records, which 8 bajillion turned out to be 2006, which trust me, if you're the one reviewing them, that can feel like 8 bajillion. And then after the process of looking at the titles and the abstracts, actually over 300 articles in their full text were reviewed, which finally whittles down to that 33. So for those in the audience thinking through, oh, this is, you know, we'll just do a systematic review. This is why these things are so challenging. And having that librarian who got that full section gave us a lot of confidence that we found anything that was out there is key. But I do want to dive into a little bit of what you were hitting on is that you categorize these using the ABIM categories and looked at, you know, what was covered and what wasn't. And here, time, life, critical conditions, those low frequency, high criticality events seem to occupy the most articles with 17, followed by things like special considerations and injury, and then 6 focused on pediatric patients. I'm curious from your point of view, are there any specific guidelines that were uncovered during this review that you think will have the greatest impact on EMS care?
Yeah, that's really always an interesting question. What I've found, I'd have to go back through the entire list of 33 guidelines. What I am always surprised when we review some of these guidelines is that it can be, it is even, as individuals who try to stay abreast of the research that's out there and, read a number of journals periodically or try to stay up, there are many publications that are out there that we just don't even know about. And sometimes the highest quality guidelines that are out there, maybe ones you may not have actually have heard about before. More than having guidelines about, obscure topics or things that they're out there. I think, what was nice is that you're finding guidelines that are out there that are high quality and are related to, specific things that otherwise you may have missed. So, out of the seven guidelines that were highest quality, so those where everything is a yes across the board there, we found, I believe, four or so American Heart Association guidelines that met all of the NAM criteria. Those were Cardiovascular Association guidelines. We had a guideline on pain management from NASEMSO, which was great and a high quality guideline there. I think that is one of those niche areas, I would say niche in that it's not cardiovascular science. It's not just about managing trauma or stroke. It's about something that becomes a day-to-day practice of EMS medicine, is how do we take care of people's pain and discomfort. And that was, I think, a nice guideline. The trauma triage guidelines came out from NUGARD and now managed by American College of Surgeons. And then a pediatric trauma hemorrhage guideline, which highlights the importance of pediatric guidelines in general. Out of the 33 guidelines, it turned out that six of them had to do with pediatric care, which was cool. Five of those, though, were cardiovascular related guidelines. And so we are still in need of more pediatric guidelines that have to do with all of the other aspects of taking care of kids in the field that aren't cardiovascular type complaints, like PALS related care. Those are some of the highlights, I think, and still some of the gaps.
I see that the payment I sent reached you. I was fishing. No, I had the opportunity to participate in the development of the guideline on pain management, and I could tell you, as somebody participating in that process, it is an incredibly rigorous and intense process to produce one of these evidence-based guidelines, and it's great to see the help with a project like this to disseminate them, and that we're focused not just on the time critical interventions, but also on what are the types of patients that EMS most frequently encounter. So when it comes to something like pain, one out of five patients that we see experiences pain, and it's important to have up-to-date guidance as medications changes or knowledge evolves on what kinds of things should we be carrying in our toolkit, and have us rethink, our pain protocols probably haven't been updated in a really long time at the service where I worked before. And so having this to guide, hold on, at least questioning what's in my toolbox and what might I be able to add is really helpful. I know that you hinted at, I love that you highlighted not just the content and the things that are really snazzy and exciting about guidelines, but you hinted at there was a fair number, 20% of these guidelines met the criteria for reporting in a way that was high quality and in a way of conducting that was high quality. But it's just as easy to say, well, only 20% of the guidelines met all of the criteria. I'm curious in your experience with this, what were some of the more common weaknesses or gaps that you noticed?
Yeah, so first off, I would say that just because they didn't meet the NAM criteria for a high quality guideline doesn't mean that it wasn't what I would say of quality, or that it is very important for that guideline and those recommendations to exist. And the distinction that we found is often actually in the reporting. We, in addition to those seven guidelines meeting all high quality guidelines, I believe there were an additional four that reported doing a systematic review of the literature, but didn't actually report the full details of a systematic review. And so, for example, one of the key things that should be included in reporting a systematic review is how it was done so that somebody can actually tell what's in the sauce. If I'm a paramedic working at my agency and I want to pay attention to a guideline and there's a recommendation that I should do X, the next step you can take is try to understand where that recommendation is going. And is there really robust science behind that recommendation that somebody found? Ideally, it would be told to you, it would be published in such a way that you could reproduce it. You could go out there looking for those publications and actually know what it is. And those are the types of elements that a guideline should include. What were the articles that were there? Is this recommendation based on a bunch of randomized controlled trials? Is it based on different levels of evidence that I think are high quality? And that way I can understand if the recommendation has a certain level of strength and importance. And so often what happens is that these guidelines report that they did do a literature review, but don't report the details of it, or maybe even that it was systematic, but don't report the elements of what they found. And so I think what we're missing in a number of these publications is in how they're reported, in the way the publications are written. So actually, with the 2022 systematic review, the PGC wrote we published a series of recommendations for how to improve the quality of EMS guidelines. And I would encourage anybody who's out there that is interested in or will in the future be participating in a panel to help inform a guideline or who might be in a position to sit down and write a guideline, take a look at that and make sure that you're trying to include the most important elements that should be in a guideline document. And I would say then you'd get all these check marks of making sure that you're including all of those things that make something high quality.
It is really important, and I like that this process teaches us to question the resources that were used to generate the guidelines and not just, well, it was published, so it has to be great, high quality evidence. That's not always the case, especially as a young profession is evolving. And so, an example that comes to mind for me almost instantly is around stroke screening. And it seems like new stroke screens are developed all the time, and we get these great results. But then, when you look at the literature that was used to validate the instruments, they're often tested within a stroke trial where we know the patient's experience an ischemic stroke, and we're seeing if that instrument works to predict large vessel occlusion. Well, of course, it performs really well within a stroke trial, but when we take that to the setting where it's intended to be applied, we often see different results. And so, having a description like this of where the evidence was collected, how it was collected, is really important when we think about how and when we should implement these. And speaking of implementation, I know that you and your team have worked on some tools around how we can use this review to inform practice and even protocol development. And so, curious your recommendations on what other resources go along with this, and how should EMS clinicians and/or their medical directors go about digesting this and deciding whether or not to implement into practice.
Yeah, so for that, I want to give another big shout out to the National Registry of EMTs, who's been a great partner and provided some funding to help put this together. And in addition to this effort is a research reading list of not only the highest quality guidelines that we have identified through these systematic reviews, but also a list of additional research publications that we help to summarize and help to disseminate. So these high quality works are being used to inform item writing for the National Registry in terms of certification examinations. And these are the types of publications that we would encourage EMS educators to incorporate into their education. And that is the key element that we really want to promote in terms of dissemination implementation. The example that I would provide is, as I have done myself, imagine that you go out and you're going to give an OB emergencies presentation to your local EMS agency. And you've got that handy dandy PowerPoint that you have dusted off every other year for the past decade. Never, never, right?
I feel called out.
And imagine that you actually wanted to make this up to date and wanted to incorporate the latest recommendations or the latest science. Wouldn't it be great if you could easily access a document that tells you about some of the latest high quality science out there and some of the latest high quality guidelines out there that you could simply incorporate into your educational offerings? So, plug to the website prehospitalguidelines.org. If you go to the top page, not only do we have a repository of all of the guidelines that we have found in our three systematic reviews, but we have an EMS research reading list, which includes the seven high quality guidelines and 10 high quality research publications and position statements that EMS personnel should be aware of. They've got summaries, which are two pagers, that can be incorporated by anybody that is out there to teach EMS professionals or by EMS professionals yourselves that want to just find out more about this, but don't want to read too much because you ain't got the time for it. None of us do, really. And you can access those and find out in a very simple, hopefully accessible method what those key things are. And those are the types, that is the type of content that is being incorporated into, the latest testing questions and also should be incorporated into continuing education. Stay up to date with the literature.
And what a helpful resource that is. It's Cliff's Notes that you won't get in trouble for using. And I think I'm dating myself because I'm sure Cliff's Notes are not the thing anymore. There's something else out
I
there.
get the reference. I get the reference.
Good times. I will invite the other panelists to hop in with any questions. And I do have a couple more. I know that you've worked with Dr. Fish a lot, and she's focused on implementation science. And although we're seeing great progress with how rapidly something like this can go from a guideline into a national registry validated test item, I'm curious that we don't see an incredibly quick uptake still around implementation of evidence-based guidelines. And I'm curious your thoughts around what barriers exist in translating, especially these high-quality guidelines, into practice across EMS systems.
Yeah, so Dr. Fish has been a great partner for us in the PGC. She chairs our Dissemination Implementation Committee, and she helped lead for us a systematic review of implementation science publications around EMS. And essentially, the punchline, as you can imagine, is that there's a limited amount of implementation science out there for EMS. So some of what the PGC is trying to do now is try to figure out how can we take the lessons learned from experts in implementation science in other fields and try to apply them to implementation of guidelines in the pre-hospital setting. Some of that has to do with trying to figure out what methodology or what tools would be best to be used. Some of it has to do with the nitty-gritty of how is it that you can actually get EMS practitioners out there to do the things we want them to do, or the things that are evidence-based. What I would say is some of the simplest things that can be incorporated in a guideline is at least some mention, some content in there that addresses how recommendations may be disseminated or implemented. Sample protocols can be particularly helpful. And other guidelines have actually created a checklist that can help with implementation to say, if you want to implement these recommendations in your setting, you should do these things. And then you can evaluate if it was actually implemented and put into place by looking for these things. Another element of trying to implement these into the world is then to develop performance measures around these guidelines, which brings up another great partner in this evolution, which is the National EMS Quality Alliance, who has really fomented the effort of developing performance measures for EMS and has partnered in taking a look at what the highest quality guidelines are out there and then trying to look at the performance measures that exist or may be created around recommendations that are evidence-based, and trying to figure out how we can then assess if our EMS agencies are actually implementing recommendations.
Absolutely. And this will be where I put in the plug that as EMS leaders and those of us involved in quality improvement efforts, that publishing the findings of a quality improvement project to an increase adherence to one of these evidence-based guidelines, especially those where NEMSQ was developed to measure, is incredibly important and helpful for other agencies to avoid reinventing the wheel and learn what practices worked really well elsewhere that I might be able to apply. So pre-hospital emergency care, where this article is published, actually accepts both research and quality improvement articles. And so for those of you listening who are going to go home and read all, especially all seven of the guidelines that had all of the criteria met, make sure that as you take on these improvement projects, you're thinking of ways to help disseminate the findings from that work too. Tony.
So this has been a great discussion, and I'll hear every now and then from clinicians in the field who actually are doing this work every day, you know, well, I didn't get a chance to participate in these guidelines. Nobody asked me, right? And for those folks who legitimately want to get involved in this work, what advice would you give them?
Yeah, so the first step is to try to get connected with some of the organizations that are traditionally creating some of these guidelines. So, you know, if you think about, you know, if you look at the list of guidelines and who's actually creating the individual guidelines, we already talked about entities like the American Heart Association. They're always looking for individuals to be involved in new guideline panels. They have open calls periodically, quite frequently, for folks to be involved in their guideline development, that they're particularly, you know, interested in folks that are, they're doing the work and can provide that input in the technical expert panel. We talked about, you know, American College of Surgeons work with their group to do things. The National Association of State EMS Officials, NASEMSO, is another entity that right now creates a lot of guidelines in partnership with NHTSA. And we talked about, you know, the pain guideline. There's an airway guideline that was very high quality, published just after our systematic review. And these are guidelines for which they have a generally broad technical expert panel, and they often want to have individuals that are involved. So think about which of these associations you may want to connect with, get involved with. When you see open calls for individuals to be involved in a technical expert panel, or if you have the opportunity to start being involved in other projects of those entities, that is a great way to get involved in some of this. And as soon as you get involved in one, let me tell you that they're going to grab you for the next one, because this work is ongoing.
And there's no shortage of articles that need reviewed out of that 2006 that we start off with. And I'll put in a plug for that too. I think it's really important. And we hear words like technical expert panel, and that's where the imposter syndrome tends to grab us. But having frontline EMS clinicians be part of these guideline development efforts helps avoid some of the barriers you spoke earlier about is, okay, great, we changed compression ratios, but we didn't think through the collaboration, the coordination with the devices and what that cost is going to look like for EMS agencies. Similar, if I recommend this medicine is now like the thing to have, well, what are the costs and the implications associated with that? And where can we preemptively remove some of those barriers, perhaps?
Yeah. And as we think about, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about the NAM criteria because those are the simplest to understand. It's they either did or didn't include those components. But at that agree to scoring checklist of 23 items across six domains, some of those components have to do with this piece that we're talking about right now. Did they include the values and preferences of the population? Did they include information about how that recommendation is to be implemented? Did they consider some of the issues that may occur with it? And it's very difficult to understand all of that if you don't have people involved that are doing this day to day. And that is, in fact, how individuals, as you mentioned, can be an expert. You are an expert in doing your job, in doing it day to day. And that we need to continue to have that perspective, or else we'll fail in being able to create recommendations and implement them.
Absolutely. Michael.
I was just wondering if it seems to me there's very robust guidelines, sort of, we've got cardiac, we've got trauma, we've got airway. Is there anywhere that you think that we really didn't have any guidance that met the robustness that we needed in order to make a recommendation that we need future research on, or something that surprised you in terms of like, gosh, I would have thought we had more out there on that, or we would have had research that met the higher level of criteria for a specific topic?
Yeah, and unfortunately there remain, you know, a variety of areas where there are no true guidelines, period, out there. The first one that I'll mention we talked a little bit about before was behavioral health emergencies, psychiatric emergencies. We had a previous publication that looked at, that performed a gap analysis of where we need new guidelines or where we need updated guidelines. And that was one of the top three subjects or content areas that were identified. The other ones were airway, and now we have a new airway guideline. The other one was pediatrics, and we keep having more pediatric guidelines. But behavioral emergencies continues to be a gap out there. Fortunately, there's a review of the literature that's being carried out to hopefully in the future have a guideline related around it, but continues to be a gap. Other aspects really are around your bread and butter EMS calls, you know, simple things. You know, we have very limited OB emergencies type guidance out there, particularly for the 911 call. Abdominal pain, renal emergencies, you know, all of the other less exciting topics per se that we have to deal with really have limited research and therefore limited evidence-based guidelines to support them. So we have to keep thinking about all of those other common calls that we get in EMS and how we continue to investigate what we should or shouldn't do during those calls.
Great. I appreciate it.
It is always interesting to take a look at where we've come and where we are, and that there is still, EMS is a relatively young profession, and there is still so much research that is needed. So I'll put the plug out there for that. Now, I know that we're winding down on our time, but I am curious, as you've talked about, this was the third iteration of this, and the Pre-Hospital Guidelines Consortium conducts this sort of review every other year. How do you see this process evolving for the next iteration? Is there something that, you know, you would do differently or something that you can see coming, especially as you mentioned how many guidelines were published in just this last review period?
Yeah, one key thing that we'll keep doing is always refining our search terms and our search criteria to make sure that we're as inclusive as possible. So that's something that we'll continue to refine as we can. And just keep thinking through how can we make these most accessible and really the dissemination of these findings to folks. So now that we have our, you know, two-pager evidence summaries for the highest quality guidelines, we want to make sure that we don't just identify these guidelines and evaluate them, but try to get them in the hands of folks to read them and be aware of that. I believe Bill has another question for us. And you got muted.
I didn't do it.
She didn't see that I jumped on. So
I did.
Hi there. So first of all, thank you very much. I've enjoyed a great deal. And two things. One, it's very interesting that I've been delving into the history of ambulances back a great deal of time, but also that and means looking at also cardiac arrest care, mouth-to-mouth ventilation, all the stuff that preceded that. But one of the things I found interesting is there sometimes misreferences. The references are incorrect. And it's interesting the number of times I've run across that. And it could be simple that they put the wrong volume in, they put the wrong year in. It's interesting that I've run across that more than I thought I would. So I find for myself, what I do is I always go through their references and I try to find the articles that they used for that. And I have not been able to find some, like they don't exist or the journal just isn't published anymore. And that I have found interesting. But what I wanted to mention to the audience is we go through this change and I have a little different point of view than Rembly on the how long EMS has been around. But when you go back and you look historically, it was actually the American College of Surgeons starting in the 1920s who began to bring to the attention of the problem of trauma and particularly trauma for motor vehicle accidents because the motor vehicle was a relatively new tool. And as roads improved, speeds improved and more people were getting injured. And then also the industrialization of America led to the need for trauma care. And then the next thing that began to happen in the 50s and the 60s was actually the look at cardiac arrest and electricity, mouth to mouth, chest compressions, and all that really developed. So it doesn't surprise me by your statement that there's a lot of literature in those two areas because they've been around the longest. And it's fascinating to read how things that are almost 100 years old are still in practice today. That's some of the things that I find. And the people that thought of it, I give them great credit. It just seemed to make sense to them, and they get the credit. So those are two things I just wanted to share. But thank you for your time and all of your effort.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I know we're running down on time. I think what I would take from those comments in particular is recognizing that we've come a long way in the way that we are now creating science in EMS. When you're talking about starting off with, you know, the Big Orange Book and thinking about how we start off just thinking about trauma care out in the highways, and then you start developing some science on cardiovascular resuscitation. Certainly we do a lot of that still, but we were taking a lot from the hospital environments. If it worked in the hospital, it must work in the pre-hospital setting. If it works for trauma, it must work for medical conditions. Now, especially in the past decade, we are in a world where we are doing a lot of cutting edge, real research in the pre-hospital setting. We need to make sure that that gets incorporated into recommendations that could guide care. We need to know that those recommendations are out there and what their quality is. And we need to figure out ways to disseminate those, to implement them in our environment, and to actually utilize all of that great knowledge that's out there. And that's what we're hoping that all of this effort helps to achieve.
And I think that only becomes more and more important as the speed with which publications happen increases and the adoption of new programs too, that instantly come to mind that, you know, I'm hopeful that we'll start to see some evidence-based guidelines emerge are around substance use disorders and these programs to administer buprenorphine in the field. And of course, it wouldn't be a podcast without talking about whole blood, but that's one where there's huge implications in implementation and what it's going to do to hospitals and blood banks. So things for us to definitely keep an eye on. Now, I do have the really unpopular task of keeping us on time. And so we are ending, but I want to give you the last word and ask, what is a key takeaway from all of this that you would like EMS clinicians to get out of it?
EMS research is out there. We have the opportunity to do things that are based on real science. We need to know about what guidelines are out there and how robust they are, how well they are written, and whether they are based on robust science. And we should try to figure out how to incorporate those into the day-to-day education that we provide to EMS clinicians and to ourselves. So if you haven't yet, take a look at prehospitalguidelines.org. You will access all of this information. It's freely available. Those research summaries are available. Consider incorporating them in the classroom and for your own knowledge.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you and your entire co-author team for this work and for continuing to do this work. We look forward to checking back in on the next iteration of this. So appreciate you once again for sharing your time with us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
And for the rest of you, I would like to thank you for tuning in and remind you that we still have the education version of this podcast Friday, February 28th, and we will be back here next month with the clinical podcast on Monday, March 10th. Thank you all again for your participation, and we look forward to nerding out again next time.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at pcrfpodcast.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website, prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsors, Limmer Education, providing educational tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey, and ESO, dedicated to improving community health and safety through the power of data.